This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Life lessons and a vision for change. If you'd like a copy of today's broadcast, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Fels, Sarah Monte, Nareen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff, Hani Massoud, Robbie Karen, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, engineer. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grant, Jessica Lee, John Wallach, Ahmed Abdelkaddous, Vesta Gadarz. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is 8 a.m. Stay tuned next for Positively Revolting Talk Radio. This morning, Ani and Lynn will speak with Doug Fine about his book, Too High to Fail, and his recent article on the five myths about legalizing marijuana. Coming up next, right after this announcement.
I'm Bobby Davis. After a life of crime and addiction and 18 years in prison, I decided to make a change. I wrote and illustrated a children's book that was recently published. Who says people can't change? Hear my story. Tune into Prison Pipeline July 8th at 6:30 p.m.
And good morning indeed. It is about 4 minutes past 8 o'clock in the morning here in the greater Cascadia area. You are tuned to KBOO, your very own community radio station.
That's 90.7 on the FM dial.
It is.
Or KBOO.FM if you are on the interwebs.
Anywhere
or
in
go
the
them.
World.
Anywhere, worldwide.
So you're listening to Positively Revolting. I'm Ani. And
I'm Lynn.
Yes. Lynn is back. We are happy she's feeling better this week. Of course, we're both going to be gone next week. That's another detail. We'll get to that later. And leaving our show in the hands of the ultimately capable and, in fact, brilliant Sarah Sneath.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, back at the ranch this week, when we are both here and both feeling peppy as all get out, we are going to be talking with Doug Fine. We're looking at the economic impact of the legalization of cannabis. We're looking at the failed drug war. And Doug Fine actually is no stranger to Positively Revolting. Thank you for coming back, Doug.
Oh, you guys are really the best, and KBOO is just immediately on whenever I'm in Portland, so thanks for having me.
Awesome. So Doug is a freelance writer, and I have to say you have some of my favorite descriptors that I've ever found in a biography, you know, author bio there on your website, where I find that, in fact, you enjoy drumming, spirit dancing, distance running, backpacking, rafting, kayaking, meditation, singing at the top of one's lungs, the art of conversation, the art of silence, frisbee, and the beach.
And on Google Images, I saw a number of goats with you.
Yeah, I'm fairly goat obsessed,
actually. I share that.
They're friendly, and they, you know, give me yogurt.
So. Okay. I mean, what's
not
to love?
Do you have some that give you yogurt immediately? That is amazing. I want some of those goats.
It's really easy to make the yogurt. You just take the previous day's yogurt, you know.
I know. I'm having you on.
We'll get into the food show later. But anyway, Doug, welcome back to Positively Revolting. We are so happy to be talking with you again. When we talked to you last time, you had just put out your latest book, which was Too High to Fail, Cannabis and the New Green Economic Revolution. And now you're back because, in fact, this book has been a success. It's just been released in paperback, and you'll be coming to town next week, giving a talk at PALS, I do believe. And we'll have more information about that in just a moment. But this is a good time, once again, to look at the topic and, in fact, to see how things have changed in the last couple of years. So I want to start off with a real primer sort of question. What do you mean by the new green economic revolution?
Well, cannabis is already America's number one crop, but with some exception, and big exceptions. And California generated $100 million in tax revenue last year just from medical cannabis dispensaries that are above ground. But for the most part, this biggest, most profitable crop in the nation is not part of the above-ground economy. It's part of a criminal economy, and that's bad for the economy. It's also bad for public safety. I say that as a father. Any places that have legalized anything, going back to alcohol prohibition and more recently to cannabis in places like Portugal and the Netherlands, has seen a drop in the use rates for youth. Now, whatever one thinks about the plant, and I think cannabis is a pretty terrific plant when used responsibly for whatever, you know, use an adult would have, I generally think that, except in the case of medical emergencies, minors shouldn't be using it. So for all of these reasons, it's a green revolution in terms of money green, but also if done right, and this is kind of my big thing now, that the drug war seems almost won, and that's, excuse the ramble here, but you accurately pointed out how much has changed since this book came out a year ago. It's the entire drug war's Berlin Wall has changed. Everything has changed, not just in the U.S. with Colorado and Washington's full adult legal social legalization of cannabis, but worldwide the truth is being spoken, and it's pretty much done. The drug war is pretty much done. And the U.S. House of Representatives passed a hemp legalization bill, a provision in a farm bill that ultimately failed, nothing to do with hemp. So even Congress is starting to move towards ending the drug war, and there was no huge ramification. The walls of Congress did not fall down. People are not being impeached on a 225-200 vote legalizing hemp. But the other meaning of green, really quickly, that we can talk about is sustainability. The cannabis legalization can be the best or the worst for the planet, and that's something that's very important to me.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you wrote an article about the five myths about legalizing marijuana, which is you're kind of talking about here. And one, if pot is legal, more people will use it. You know, that's a big one.
Right, and let's be clear, we're talking about myths, in other words, things that are not true.
Right. That's a big myth. That is in the back of a lot of people's mind. Just like the old notion that pot is a gateway drug. They don't ever say, but that's not true.
40 years of brainwashing and propaganda and myths and some people are going to die hard, but it is dying out. Everywhere I go, I'm meeting people in Texas and Missouri and, you know, places that are not thought of as, you know, Portlandia, that are that are just
well, actually, you know, Washington legalized it way before Oregon did.
Well, I mean,
we have not, which is what I'm going to say, is we have not. Yeah, Portlandia is not the oasis that Washington is now, but that's, I just wanted to put that in there.
That's a good point. And also, it's going to happen really soon. You guys have a really awesome network happening now in the Beaver State, and it's part of the National Cannabis Coalition. They're really top-notch people that are getting it done effectively on the political side and making the good points. You know, this is not about tie-dyes and lava lamps. This is about benefits to...
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
Exactly. Gosh,
just kidding.
Exactly. Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
Yeah. But it's really about convincing... Let's put it this way. It's about people convincing folks, truthfully, folks that are not into tie-dyes and lava lamps, that it's still better for America to end the drug war, just as with all of alcohol's problems, prohibition was not the answer. It just created organized crime.
Yeah. Yeah, that is the other... there's a thing called drug peace that you were talking about that's really challenging the whole war on drugs, which... what a waste of money.
Definitely.
Don't you think?
It's America's most expensive war, and it's just, at this point, it's bureaucratic inertia. I want to make a plug here for saying that I appreciate law enforcement. There's a reason we have law enforcement, and most law enforcers are doing their job. But when you have DEA administrators sending around a memo urging Congress to oppose legalizing hemp, which isn't even psychoactive, with ridiculous flat-out lies about it, you know, who knows, it could be used to smoke, or it can't be told, they can't tell the difference from smokable cannabis. It's just an absurd claim. That's about protecting jobs, bureaucratic inertia, and that's another reason just why the taxpayer should be in support of ending the drug war.
Absolutely. So if we could look for a moment about the cost of the drug war, I mean, there's so many things to look at. A lot of people immediately jump to the economic costs, and certainly those are huge. When you look at incarceration rates, when you look at enforcement, courts, all of that, the system that it takes to wage this war. But then there are also other costs in productivity and costs in human lives, as people's families are torn apart, as people lose jobs, as people really lose their life by being suddenly caught up in the system for having a pocket full of flowers. So, you know, can you talk about the total, the sort of larger cost? And actually, I'm going to throw in there that another cost that always goes hand in hand with prohibition is, in fact, the rise of crime, as you touched on earlier. But I think that's another major cost of the failing drug war, is that it makes it possible. It provides an atmosphere verdant for drug dealers, narcotraficantes, and the like.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, we've established now in 40 years, 10 times longer than World War II, that prohibition doesn't work on any level. It doesn't reduce supply. It doesn't reduce youth access. It doesn't hurt. It doesn't do anything except for help criminals. Now, when it comes to a large bureaucracy, we as taxpayers often begrudgingly accept the reality of, in a big country with 300 million people, there's going to be sometimes big bureaucratic engines that either work efficiently, as some do, or not as great as we would like, but we kind of accept them. One big example is agriculture. There's nothing like a free market economy working in the heartland's agriculture. And we taxpayers are subsidizing corn, soy, wheat, all that stuff, and various crops. And we generally accept that because we want there to be a good food supply, and we want America to, you know, be able to help countries that need food, that kind of thing. And there's not people taking to the streets saying, you know, change the farm bill, change the farm bill. And maybe, you know, maybe there should be, but
maybe there should be.
Especially when
I haven't seen them either.
Especially when it comes to GMOs, right?
Yeah.
But the fact is, we generally accept that. There's not huge debate over the farm bill. The problem with the huge bureaucracy surrounding the drug war is exactly what you pointed out, that it does terrible things to Americans. 800,000 Americans were arrested just for cannabis last year while the drug czar says that that doesn't happen anymore. As you pointed out, those are lives ruined. It is no joke to go through the criminal justice system, and people who have felonies, their lives are turned upside down. This absolutely has to stop. It's a civil liberties thing. And I'm fairly patriotic American, just from being a journalist who has reported from five continents and seen how messed up life is for so many people all over the world who don't even have the tenuous protections that we have from our Constitution. And the drug war is one of the most constitutionally violating policies we've had since segregation.
We have had segregation. Are you there?
Hi.
Oh, you're there. Okay. I heard this.
There's a strange little sound on our end. Never mind.
That's all right.
We're moving
we
on.
Will take this time to ID a bit. We're talking this morning with Doug Fine, author of Too High to Fail. He's going to be in town on July 9th at Powell's on West Burnside, and he'll be talking between 7:30 and 9:30. And because your book is being republished, is it coming out in paperback?
That's it, exactly. Yep, it's the paperback release. And the live event kind of, it's a slideshow, and it's a really, I hope, a funny tale of following this one locally developed strain. Talk about not GMO. This was a guy who developed the strain in a barn. He's a second-generation farmer in the Emerald Triangle.
Oh, yes.
And I followed it from farm to patient, and so it was a way of kind of, I think many people even who appreciate the cannabis plant still don't really know, you know, how does it work, where's it's grown, how's it's grown, what's added to it, what are the different modes of growing. I'm really, really concerned about sustainability in the cannabis plant, as I mentioned. It really, this outdoor versus indoor cultivation issue is an important one. Is it something that people are, do you think, are aware of in within Oregon?
Well, some people are, but not everyone. So, I would be interested to hear about that. I think our listeners would as well.
Well, basically, I should say by way of background, I'm a sustainability journalist, and I live on a solar-powered goat ranch in rural New Mexico, very, very far even from the closest store. And so this is who I am as a person and as a journalist. Sustainability is everything to me. I can't accept any bit. It's the first question I ask. You know, somebody says, oh, yeah, well, I'm really interested in business A. I'm like, okay, is that, what's that doing to rainforest or water supply or air quality? You know, like, mm-hmm. It, all that matters to me, really, is that we take care of our Earth for our future generations and our own generation. Mm-hmm. And so then when I started to cover, and so that I wrote a book about that called Farewell My Subaru, where I gave up my petroleum and whatever. So, no, I drive on vegetable oil, except when I fly into Oregon, in which case I buy carbon offsets, which is like cheating on your partner and then sending money to pay for it.
I know. Right. That is a very strange...
The carbon offset thing is an odd thing.
I think someone was high when they thought of that. That's all I have to say. Maybe not.
Well, 100 million Americans have used cannabis, including our last three presidents. Anyway, so on the sustainability side, it's vital to me, right? And so that's why I actually, in Too High to Fail, chose to follow the plant in Mendocino County, because their permitting program that the sheriff did there, which was a very brave move, and the farmers that came above ground to be taxpayers were very, very brave, and that's kind of what the book's about. Sustainability guidelines were written in. It takes 10 months to grow an outdoor cannabis crop under God's sun and using, you know, organic techniques, which is very, very difficult, but not impossible with indoor. One of the big problems also with indoor is indoor cultivation is energy use as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, big time.
So if you're someone who, as I'm sure many listeners are today, someone who goes to a farmer's market intending to buy broccoli explicitly from a local farmer that uses good techniques that are nice to the soil and responsibly use water and all that stuff, that person might be a cannabis aficionado too and not even realize or think about this is a plant to dealing with those same issues. So it's not quite as simple as outdoors good and indoors bad, because there can be decent indoor techniques and let's say troubling water use or whatever in outdoor, but it's much, much easier if you're doing outdoor, at least greenhousing and what they call light deprivation or transitional crops that are both greenhouse and outdoor, as much as possible, and you know, let the sun basically do the work, and let the native do the native soil do the work. Microbes and all that good stuff in the native soil is going to simply provide a better crop as it would with any crop. And I'm just trying to go around and raise awareness amongst people as the drug war. And the other big topic to me, besides sustainability, is the issue of stigma. We, because of the just say no propaganda stuff we were talking about earlier in the program, you have people who might, you know, they might vote to end the drug war. They see how not stupid it is and ineffective it is. Cannabis isn't really a factor in their life. They got a cousin who likes to smoke or something, but that's, they don't think about it too much. And some of those folks might still carry a little bit of stigma. In other words, if the Oregonian throws up a headline, pilot shows, you know, American Airlines pilot has THC in his blood, like, they might say, oh, no, that's bad, mm-hmm. when in truth, that stigma, in my view, really needs to go away for a plant which, if used responsibly by adults, is considerably less dangerous than alcohol. So there's basic rules. A pilot, if I'm not mistaken, is not supposed to have a drink within 18 hours of flying. It might be something like not on the day of, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. Similar rules should be in effect. Likewise with DUI testing, roadside, it shouldn't be what a THC level is. It should be whether or not somebody was capable to drive and was or was not sober and able to drive. So that's about law enforcement adjusting. And this isn't just about cannabis and alcohol. It's about adjusting to what America's real addiction is, which is prescription pill abuse, and having law enforcement have a tool to do testing for any kind of inebriation.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the issues that I think, as the drug war, as we have the luxury of winning the drug war and discussing what comes next, those are the issues I'm really paying a lot of attention to.
Well, I want to remind people that it is a call-in show here. You are welcome to join in our conversation at 503-231-8187 and talk with Doug Fine, your very own self. You are, in fact, listening to Positively Revolting on your community radio station, KABU. I'm Ani. We are speaking with Doug Fine, author of
Too High to Fail,
Cannabis and the New Green Economic Revolution.
And Farewell, My Subaru.
And I was going to say, and many articles. I love your blog, Doug. I really do. I've been reading it fairly frequently since you were on last time. You write with such humor and humanity, and I just really appreciate that. You will, in fact, be at Powell's on the 9th, and it's the Powell's downtown, as I do believe, and that's going to be 7:30 on the 9th. With your presentation that you were mentioning earlier, including your slideshow. So if folks want to take note of that, that's great. Also want to remind our listeners that you can follow Positively Revolting throughout the week on Facebook. If you would like to like our fan page, you can find us at facebook.com/positivelyrevolting. You can also email us, and our email address is PositivelyRevolting@gmail.com.
Yes, it is. So, Doug, getting back to the five myths about legalizing marijuana, there's a real, and I hear this from folks a lot, the big tobacco and big alcohol would control the legal cannabis industry. That is a myth. How do you, what do you say to that?
Oh, you know, that's such a good one. That's such a good question. And it ties into the sustainability sort of outdoor angle we've been discussing mm-hmm. a little bit. First of all, I live in the real world. I come from New York. I have one of my brothers, you know, has an MBA. Wall Street's going to do what Wall Street's going to do. And we as the consumer make a decision of what kind of businesses we want to support and what kind of farmers we want to support. Cannabis has the really great advantage of already being decentralized and farmer-owned. So when I spoke to the Emerald Triangle farmers who were not among the 100 farmers who came above ground to be permitted by the state.
Now, who are the Emerald Triangle farmers?
Oh, so it's these counties in Northern California, generally referred to as Mendocino County, Humboldt County, and Trinity County, mm-hmm. That are referred to as the Emerald Triangle just because, you know, 80% of the economy for generations mm-hmm. now, has been cannabis farming. And so I followed the effort, and Too High to Fail, I followed the effort of the sheriff's department to bring these folks above ground and have them pay taxes and reduce crime. And it totally worked.
Mm-hmm.
It was a complete success until the feds raided. But hopefully it will start up again as federal prohibition finally moves to its end here in the next couple of years, let us hope. I think it's going to be 2014, by the way, if not 2016, that Oregon is going to have another chance to vote on it, and 2016 for California. So it really won't be long that the chips are falling.
That's so true.
Some of these Emerald Triangle farmers were, as I spoke, and are, perfectly happy to do business the way they've always done business. And, you know, when you say, well, you know, America's winning the drug war, they're like, well, I call it winning the drug war that I put three kids through Stanford during this plan. Like, you know, there's even a renegade band in Northern California called the Camo Cowboys that has a song called Flower Police, and it speaks of the symbiotic relationship amongst law enforcers that get taxpayers' money to act like they're doing their job and flying helicopters and raiding people, but they seize at most 1% of the crop. Nobody, no local jury is ever going to convict if it's a non-federal charge in those areas, because it's a jury of your peers. They're all cannabis farmers, too. And so it kind of works well for, you know, at worst you lose 1 year's crop or whatever.
But what a silly game.
Oh, and it's immoral. Yeah, it's just terrible. And it's got involves guns, and it's just totally wrong. But the veneer of resistance to legalization is a relatively thin one. The black market farmers that didn't come above ground, amongst the 100 that I followed in the book, Too High to Fail, they were watching very closely, and they noticed how successful the program was. And I should add, as a side note, I'll be talking about this at Powell's. And also, by the way, if folks are listening to KBOO online in Redmond, Oregon, at Paulina Springs Bookstore on the 8th, the fact that these folks were really watching the program carefully as it was successful, and they were afraid that if the feds raided, the county would sort of bow down and give the feds all the records. And the county, that happened. The feds came in and subpoenaed all the records from this zip tie program, which was named because all the farmers that joined in Mendocino County had to put these yellow kind of bracelets with registration numbers on their plants. So all the plants had kind of jewelry on. And so the feds did raid and did demand all the records, and the county said, let's see, what's a non-expletive I could use? The county said...
The heck with you?
To heck with you, thank you.
Uh-huh. I'm good with the substitutions.
Beautiful. didn't give over the records and challenged it and won. And the feds backed down and now said, well, give us the records, but with all the names blacked out. They're like, okay, you want meaningless numbers? Here you go. So that was a big success, and it said a lot about this next generation of drug peace. Every piece brings a peace dividend, and you can use it well or you can use it not so well. And Mendocino County showed how it can be done in a way that benefits the community and raises a lot of money. But to get back to your question about will big alcohol, big tobacco control, one of the other concerns that longtime black market farmers have is, oh, we're just going to be put out of business because we have our roots now, we have our middlemen that buy, we know where it's going, you know, whether they're legitimate in-state medical providers or, as a majority, are black market, you know, worldwide providers, they are concerned that, you know, Marlboro or whomever is just going to have a six-pack of joints, you know, a pack of their joints in the corner store, and that nobody's going to, you know, buy from the small farmer anymore. Now, as I started off this long spiel by saying, Wall Street's going to do what it's going to do. That's going to happen, yes. But just as... And probably people in Oregon know this better than anywhere, just as microbrew is available, it's actually, I found out, a $10 billion industry, craft beer. So, sure, Coors, Budweiser, those are going to be at the ball game or whatever. Those are going to be big businesses. But the cannabis equivalent of the craft brewer, if he or she markets him or herself well enough to create what Michael Pollan calls supermarket pastoral, a nice story behind your plant. We are a farmer-owned collective in rural Oregon that uses only native soil and God's sun. And like, if that kind of farmer is going to do just fine, whether it's at the farmer's market or creating a CSA or creating a national brand, which is what the farmers that form the Emerald Growers Association down in the Emerald Triangle that we were talking about in California have done. They're trying to do what Napa did to wine and set up this multi-billion dollar tourism industry, get ready for the Bud and Breakfast.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be both. It's going to be big business going in and putting swag in the corner store. and it's going to be what do they call them? Artisanal, you know, top shelf,
right? Artisanal, the handcrafted.
You know, in Vietnam, way back when, and I was not there, but I went out with a fellow who was there for some time, and they put pot in cigarette packs. They were called Park Lanes. It's just a little thing that I've seen pictures with. Everyone had their little Park Lane thing up in the... So, yeah, sorry. It's just a little...
Lynn goes down memory lane.
There, sorry. Just a little back bit. into the Wayback Machine for just a moment.
And again, we encourage your call so that you too can jump on into this conversation on drug peace versus drug war. We're speaking with author Doug Fine. Too High to Fail is the book that is being re-released in paperback, coming out in paperback, and Doug will be speaking at PALS with full presentation, we hear, on the 9th.
A multimedia show on July 9th between 7:30 and 9:30 p.m.
And that is the main PALS downtown.
On West Burnside.
Yep.
And of course, call in this and join the conversation at 503-231-8187. You can also comment on our Facebook page, where you can find us at facebook.com/positivelyrevolting, or you can in fact email us at positivelyrevolting@gmail.com.
All those things.
And coming up later on this morning on Cable, Lynn?
Yeah, coming up on this morning on Cable at 9, APA Compass features Professor Linda Tamura, author of Nikkei Soldiers Break Their Silence, Coming Home to Hood River. At 10, both Air Cascadia and Flashpoints are off today. Instead, we'll hear Radio EcoShock on preparing personal solutions, clothes, medicine, money, and food. At 11, on It Takes a Village, host Shahid Hamid interviews Michael Alexander, president of the Urban League of Portland. And at 11:30, we hear an interview with writer and activist Rebecca Schnolle on her new book, Hollow City, which she wrote to document the beauty and rich culture of San Francisco that was being destroyed by wealth and to inspire the growing movement of resistance. And, of course, at noon, the Blues Festival is going to be happening here on Portland on KBOO and affiliates, and it will be going on till 10 o'clock at night. Is that not true, Annie Haynes?
Oh, that's very true.
Yeah. So thank you all, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a member, you can remedy that horrible situation by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. It's easy, it's fun, and you'll like yourself more.
And you know what? I got it. Just this is a total digression, and I usually don't do this. But since you mentioned the Blues Festival, and since the Blues Festival will be, in fact, on KBOO Live all day
for 10 hours,
noon to 10 tonight, I gotta say, tonight I'm kind of really excited. Hot 8 Brass Band, Carl Denson's Tiny Universe, and Eric Burden are the lineup this evening. So
it is quite a lineup this year. I gotta say,
those really excite me.
Okay. And KBOO sound is so good. I was listening to it quite a bit yesterday. It is really
Our engineer,
Tommy, thank you. Yes. The whole crew is great. Thank you so much. It's been really great.
Okay.
So, Doug.
We've digressed. Welcome back, Doug.
So tune in today, Doug, if you got an internet radio.
Definitely.
All right.
We have Harvey on the line. Good morning, Harvey. You want to join the conversation? You're on the air.
Yes, I do. Thank you, Lynn and Ani and Doug. Well, I have a few points here to make. First of all, everything in America is a business. So when you stop the war on drugs, you're goring a whole bunch. You're goring somebody's ox. And like, there's the incarceration business, prisons for profit, and pharma take a hit. Cotton will take a hit. The pesticides, fungicides, and fumicides industries are going to take a hit. There's a lot of people who take a hit. Even police, I believe that when they make a police bust, if there's cash, the cash goes toward the retirement of the police benefits fund. So Everyone's sort of making money on this. It's hard to give it up. So it's kind of... It's also political repression. You know, it turns out in certain states that mostly African American men, when they're grabbed off the streets for being street pharmacists, they lose their vote. So there's been a lot of political repression around this, like you say, this flower in your pocket, and it's a war, and essentially a war on the people of America. So you know, they bring the war home to us if they don't have an outside war. I think capitalism is war, and the government controls the people's pain and pleasure. That's one way they control people. So, you know, the marijuana is very pleasurable, so it's very carefully controlled. And the last point I wish to make is that religion in relation to pain, you know, like religion says, this is a painful life. A lot of religion says this is a painful life, but the pleasure is not here, it's in heaven. So it's, you know, don't look for it here, and this is all about pain and struggle. So the thing is they control the pleasure, the valve, and I think that's some of the reasons there. And so I feel there's a lot of investment on the part of the government to keep things under control on every level, and it's time we turn it around.
Well, thank you, Harvey.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
What say you, Doug?
Great points, Harvey. You know, on the point of the established entities that take a hit when drug peace is declared, and it's very true, actually, that reality in losing to people power, granted it took 40 years, 40-plus years, is actually regaining my faith in the system a little bit. Like, I'm thinking, boy, those founding fathers, you know, may have had some flaws, but they put together a document that is kind of working. In other words, Congress voted to legalize hemp. That U.S. House voted to legalize hemp last week, as we discussed.
Which is different than cannabis.
It is different, but boy, gosh, trying to get Congress to understand that. But even so, even if they were to tomorrow do the same thing with psychoactive side, Americans, their approval ratings would go up. Americans want it. And so it's actually the will of the people is being shouted louder than the special interests that want to keep the status quo going, which is an astounding thing, especially when law enforcement is involved in it. The truth is just speaking too loud, and I thought that didn't matter, but it actually matters. And so that's kind of a redeeming thing for me, something that gives me energy as I go about, you know, speaking about the drug piece every day and what I've seen on the ground from the front lines as far as drug policy. One other nice thing I wanted to point out about the zip tie model in Mendocino that can be a model for locavore cannabis farmers nationwide or worldwide is that cannabis stalks, the actual cellulose of the stalks, are basically not usable for social/spiritual/medicinal/health maintenance cannabis, otherwise known as psychoactive cannabis. You know, you're not using the stem. So what the plan was/is, the feds shut down the program before they really got any of this rolling, was to create centralized flower trimming facilities, which would not only allow uniformity of strains, but uniformity of quality testing, making sure there's no mold, analyzing what cannabinoids or components of the plants are in it, and just making an all-around stressful time for cannabis farmers much easier by having a central facility that creates jobs, makes the process much more secure, et cetera, et cetera. Basically professionalizes the business. But what they wanted to do with the stocks was to create a fermentation facility, and this is done in other parts of the world with hemp and other crops, and create ethanol and other types of energy by using the stocks there. So you can actually be a net energy producer for your county, make your region energy independent from the cannabis crop. So there's just a lot of, if the drug war ends and the above ground consumer is born aware of this, of basically supporting your local cannabis farmer, I think we might see benefits to the planet as well as to public safety.
Sounds very elegant.
Doesn't it? Drug peace really is, I think. Yeah. In my personal opinion, I gotta say. Let's talk to Ross.
Good morning, Ross.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
I was hoping your guests could comment on the recent data released about the rates of arrest for marijuana possession in the simplified terms, black versus white. I think the feds found that the rate of arrest was six times higher for blacks than for whites, even though the per capita rate of use of marijuana is relatively the same for blacks versus whites. So maybe he could comment on how the prison industrial complex and sort of a tendency toward racist policing policies plays into the drug war, and any specific alliances or coalitions between the like the Drug Policy Alliance and the ACLU, where those where that intersectionality lies.
Well, that was quite a question.
It's a great question. So, as a rural American who has primarily researched from the production side, I have, I wouldn't say a different take, but I would say I have a so to speak, higher altitude take on drug war and how it's prosecuted, how it's implemented. So here's the deal. It's such, we're spending $40 billion of taxpayer money worldwide on the drug war. We're setting up in places like East Africa, new DEA airstrips and things to,
right.
Because maybe some contraband is being smuggled into Europe. Why? That's a concern to American taxpayers. I'm not quite sure.
Mm-hmm.
So there's so many ways, and I want to give a personal example too before I further answer the question specifically with regard to race. But a personal example, in my very remote New Mexico Valley, I normally wake up to the sound of hummingbird wings in the feeder outside the window right near my bed. That's how quiet it is. I mean, hummingbird, as anyone who's been around them know, they're loud, but, I mean,
right.
Not that loud.
Right.
Instead, one morning, it was the final scene of the movie in Goodfellas. There was helicopters and planes, and what it was, I thought I was in trouble for a petition I had signed against fracking, but it turned out it was my neighbor, a retiree, an AARP member,
mm-hmm.
who had something like a dozen plants just prior to the implementation of New Mexico's very successful medical cannabis program. He needed it for PTSD-type stuff and was self-medicating, and someone evidently had turned him in, and all of a sudden, this pot of fun for some interagency border area narcotics interdiction force, which should have been fighting cartels or meth or something, swoops in because we paid them millions of dollars to do so and wastes millions of dollars of taxpayers' money, brings automatic weapons instead of coyotes into my creek beds, putting my family and my children in danger. And hence the drug war is fun. This was, by the way, the incident that caused me to write Too High to Fail. The bottom line is, when drug war money is given to agencies, wherever the agencies are, they become addicted to it. These are my words. This is Norm Stamper, a longtime chief of Seattle Police, and active in law enforcement against prohibition, a 5,000-member and growing organization of law enforcers that are trying to tell the truth about all this. So what's been getting a lot of statistic lately with the ACLU report, and the news was out there about this before then, was this one type of drug war funding that's common in cities. And New York had already had a scandal surrounding this called Stop and Frisk. The bottom line is, certain of these pots of money that we pay in our taxes go based on the number of quote-unquote drug arrests, right? So the easiest thing in the world to do for a cop to do is to walk around a neighborhood where people are terrified of the police, stop young men, often whose skin is of a darker shade, and convince them to open up their pockets, and oops, there you go, there's a little bit of cannabis in there, I'm making an arrest. And those numbers add up, and they result in more money for the department. It's unconscionable, and it's horrible, and insane, as all of the drug war is,
mm-hmm.
putting people in prisons and all that. And I don't even want to say but here, I guess I'll say and. It's just one type of abuse. Believe me, in Northern California, it doesn't matter what your color of your skin is. I'll give you an example. The U.S. attorney, federal U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Colorado, in the years that I was researching the situation up there, unilaterally awarded more than $100,000 to a local municipality in Eastern California. Just thanks for helping us out with the raid last week. Here's $100,000 we seized from an American. Federal law doesn't even require giving back drug seizures, even if no one's ever tried or convicted. State laws after long battles, do now require that in most states. But federal law, absurdly, you know, if someone decides that random dentist might have had some drug connection, takes away his home, boat, car, money, bank account, and then, oops, sorry, we made a mistake. It wasn't this dentist. It was this ophthalmologist in a different state. There's no law saying the feds have to give that property back. And as part of that parasitic seizure, it's just, oh, here you go. Here, the federal prosecutor just gave six figures to a municipality in California. Thanks for helping us fight the drug war. So it's abuses nationwide of all creeds and colors. And the scandal surrounding race is horrible, but it's a scandal top to bottom. The drug war is a scandal, and the drug war needs to end.
Well, and I think both Harvey and Ross were commenting on the prison industrial complex, because arresting folks, it's a great color, you know, arresting folks for the bud in their pocket, and there are more black people arrested than white people, or that's simply a fact. But that gets lots more folks for the prison industrial complex, because prisons are becoming privatized.
Oh, yeah, no question about it. In fact,
I just had to buy license plates, and they were really expensive, so I don't understand that. But
you know, you're absolutely right. Many of listeners will already be aware of these stats, but we have 2.3 million Americans in prison, which is several hundred thousand more than China, land of the free. Isn't that nice? And even private prison companies are making deals with municipalities in places like Arizona and elsewhere, saying, listen, you guys currently pay, you know, $20,000 per prisoner per bed per year. We'll save you money. We'll pay you $17,000. You only need to pay us $17,000, and I'm approximating numbers here, per prisoner per year. But you need to guarantee us we're going to have 95% incarceration capacity. In other words,
fill them up.
You need to promise us you're going to fill the prison. Is that some way to run a country or an economy? Of course.
If you build them,
they will come.
And again, looking at that profit motive, looking at what props up the prison industrial complex, since really all categories of crime have gone down, that linkage between the drug war and the prison industrial complex, I think, can be underscored again. What do you think, Doug?
It's 100% exactly what you're saying. It's an industrial complex. I'll give you another example, and this is the reason why I don't mean to downplay the racial profiling, because it is real, and it's especially a problem in cities. I'm just pointing out that the drug war is a problem nationwide, worldwide, of people of all races, creeds, and colors. Just to tell you something that happened to me. Soon after I moved to Mendocino County, which I did for a year to follow this long 10-month growing season, and support your outdoor cannabis farmers, folks. That's a 10-month process, not 10 weeks indoors, 10 months outdoors.
Nice plug. Very good plug.
A very friendly county in Mendocino, right? I'm driving out on my vegetable oil-powered truck out of Mendocino County, because I had to get down to the Bay Area. And almost immediately, in Sonoma County, I'm pulled over on Highway 101 under a beautifully ironic billboard reading, "Grab some buds," one of those Budweiser billboards. And the officer falsely claimed that he spilled cannabis in my car. And this was great for the book, terrifying at the time. I don't know if you guys have, you know, been walked with your hands behind your back with no lights read into the wrong side of a police car, but this had never happened to me before.
It's an unsettling feeling.
What's that?
It's an unsettling feeling.
Oh, it is.
I say with a, you know, that British understatement that I was raised with. Unsettling.
Exactly right. It was not my most emotive moment. So I'm sitting in the back seat of this car watching them pull out my kids' car seats and search through my truck. And eventually they let me go. So I come back to Mendocino County and I start to whine about this to the farmers that I'm following. And they're kind of blinking at me expressionlessly and checking their cell phones, see if they need to reply to a text that just came in. And decidedly, their reaction is decidedly not
nonplussed.
Shocked and sending me to their local civil rights lawyer. They call it the cost of doing business. They call that stretch of Highway 101 the gauntlet. And the bottom line is, to quote Matt Cohen, the farmer that I first whined about this to, he goes, dude, you're a youngish guy in a beard leaving Mendocino County in a truck. Of course you got profiled. That's what they do.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, well, what would they have done if they had found, you know, like if, you know, some farmer that I'd been driving with to their farm had dropped a, you know, branch or something, goes, oh, they wouldn't have even bothered with you. They were curious whether or not you had 100 pounds. That's all they wanted to know. And, you know, I'm someone who at that point had never seen more than, like, an eighth of an ounce in one spot. I'm like, 100 pounds? And they're like, yeah, that's what they're looking for. That's what the – and so I did the math on how much drug war funding goes to that area of the country. And in the 20 minutes that they had me, they wasted 11,000 taxpayer dollars finding nothing on me. And they just do it all day, every day, just pull over. I smell cannabis, get out of the truck.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, it's a business. It's an industrial complex that changes when when cannabis gets out of the Controlled Substances Act.
And I want to remind people, we are talking with Doug Fine. I'm Ani.
I'm Lynn.
Together we are Positively Revolting. And in fact, Doug Fine is the author of Too High to Fail, Cannabis and the New Green Economic Revolution. This is coming out in paperback, and it's being released and to go on tour, as it were, and talk about the issues and, in fact, have a nifty slideshow, I understand. Doug will be presenting at PALS downtown next week on July 9th, 7:30 at the main PALS on 10th and Burnside. So just wanted to make sure we got that in there again. We have only a few minutes left in the show. If you want to get in with a very quick question or comment, you can still do that at 503-231-8187. You can also leave comments on our Facebook page where you can like us. You can find us as Positively Revolting. And you can, in fact, email us, positivelyrevolting@gmail.com. Looking at how many states have legalized cannabis since we last talked, you know, it's been about 18 months. Looking at the changes, and as you've said this morning, you can see that that we are really on the verge of drug peace. How do you think, as we've been doing this state by state, and I agree, I concur, I think that Oregon will be joining the ranks of those that absolutely legalize. I mean, of course, we were the first state to decrim in 72. But at the same time, looking at actually legalizing it state by state, how do you feel the feds are eventually going to respond to that? I mean, even if each state legalized, we still have the feds to be concerned with, yeah?
Yeah, definitely. Anybody who has tried to ignores it at their peril, unfortunately, up to this point. But the good news is I do think that the state route is an important part of the process. We were talking a little bit earlier about people power and will of the people. One of the national cannabis organizations, activist organizations, has a campaign that goes along the lines of something like 26 states by 2020 or something like that, because that was the number, maybe it was 27 states, because that was the number that sort of tipped it when it came to alcohol prohibition.
Yep.
So it is going to, the state by state stuff, although meaningless on the federal level, is important because that represents more and more of the population of America, meaning more and more members of Congress in districts that have voted, and they watch these things. They know that more people voted for legalization than voted for Obama in Colorado. They know that youth voting rates were up 12% in Colorado and 6% in Washington in 2012 versus 2008. That's like the holy grail, especially for Democrats, is trying to figure out how to get youth voters just to the polls. And even among the traditionally sort of resistant demographics when it comes to drug peace, namely elderly people, older folks, that's changing. They're still in the lowest.
Well, look category. Who's getting older.
Exactly.
Boomers.
And they're discovering, even if they were only tried cannabis a few times in college, they know it's not going to kill them. They see their friends are getting off debilitating pharmaceuticals for, let's say, arthritis or whatever.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's, I went to dispensaries in very conservative Orange County. This is where Richard Nixon was from. And found a lot of people who are called themselves conservatives that were patients there. So yes, you're absolutely right. That's one reason that the drug war is ending, is even older folks are
Well, it's nice that the boomers aging is good for something.
It's just one of those natural processes.
I know.
Then it's going to happen.
You're easily the funniest host that I ever interacted with.
And you're one of the most humorous authors I think we've gotten a chance to talk with. So
we have
back at you.
We've got one more person. We've got somebody on the line, and we can like squeeze her in. Jen.
Good morning, yeah. Jen. You're on the air.
Hi. Good morning. I caught the very tail end of the show, and I'd really enjoy like to meet, you know, and talk about stuff with you, the author. I thank you for your name is Doug Klein.
Doug Fine.
Doug Fine. He will be here. He will be in Portland on July 9th. And he's going to be on. Yeah, he's going to be at Powell's on West Burnside between 7:30 and 9:30.
Cool. I just kind of missed what day. But anyway, I was in Mendocino for a couple of years and just got the experience of being down there and seeing what, you know, the feds working with the county and raiding a lot of people that are medical. I mean, I was medical in California since 2006. I've been medical here the whole time I've been here since 2009 or 2010 maybe. But, you know, got raided 2 years in a row as a medical patient in 2008 and in 2009. And, you know, really pretty ridiculous. Felt like it was even, you know, we was in Ukiah and they outlawed being able to grow outside because they said it was a public nuisance for people to be able to grow their medicine outside. And I really feel like that's ridiculous to be able to use, you know, God's, you know, whatever. I don't, you know, believe to call it God or whatever spirituality you want to.
The sun. We'll call it the sun.
Yeah, the sun, exactly, because that's what, you know, gives everything life. And that's what, you know, is the natural thing to grow with. And to be able to push people inside and then come in and say, you know, we're going to arrest you right after there was a Measure B that passed in 2008 that, kicked you down to six plants. They arrest, you know, they profiled people, came in, arrested patients. We got arrested. We're told that we should go up to Spy
Rock. Jen,
we
only have about 1 minute left. So.
Sorry, we were told we should go up to Spy Rock to grow. The next year they came and raided, the Mendocino Crimes Task Force came and raided Spy Rock, Bell Springs, and Dos Rios Road that very next year and raided a bunch of people growing up there, and it's ridiculous, you know, I felt. And when they raided us, they threw like 12 people in a van. It was like 115 degrees out. Shut up all the doors and windows, drove us down the road for they were in there for 5 or 10
right,
minutes with everything
right,
shut
right.
up.
Well,
they're just so ridiculous.
Thank you so much for your call. We're going to have to
cut
it.
Yeah.
No, that's all right. We're going to have to cut it short because we're running out of show. So thank you very much, Jen.
Thank you so much for being here, and I'll definitely be there on July 9th at Powell. So.
Okay.
Well, wonderful.
Well, you all got right. one in your audience so far. Doug.
Sure.
I'm thinking he has more. Doug, do you have any final words? We have just about a minute left.
To Oregonians, support ending the drug war as it comes up, whether 2014 or 2016. And if you want to get involved, you know, check out efforts within the state, including via the National Cannabis Coalition. And I look forward to seeing you all on July 9th.
Absolutely. He'll be there July 9th, 7:30 to 9:30, Powell's on West Burnside. That's Doug Fine will be there with his multimedia show.
And
we'll be back in 2 weeks. Doug, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Doug, for joining us. It's always a pleasure to talk with you and look forward to doing so again sometime soon. We've been speaking with Doug Fine, author of Too High to Fail. He will be appearing at Powell's next Tuesday night, the 9th, 7:30, Powell's downtown. And I look forward to talking to you about many sustainability issues in the future, really. It'll be fun.
Same here.
Right on.
Support KBOO, everyone.
Thanks very much. And we will be back in two weeks. Actually during a special and fabulous fun day of fundraising. Yes.
Yeah.
It's all true. And I will actually, you won't be back in 2 weeks, will you, little Missy?
Oh, that's right. I won't.
So I will be here positively revolting, as you might imagine. And I will be with the incomparable Teresa Mitchell, as we will be discussing climate change.
Excellent.
That's what's going to happen in 2 weeks.
That's right. Well, that's good.
You'll see Lynn in 3 weeks if you peer really hard through the speakers of your radio. Okay.
Thanks, everyone.
With that, we make way. And thank you so much for listening to KBOO, your very own community radio station.
And your and a progressive talk radio 5 days a week, 8 to 9. Stay positively revolting, kids.
That's it.
This is it. second every day, when every action, every thought will tell the world how you cast your vote.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to broadcast the 26th Annual Waterfront Blues Festival, a benefit for the Oregon Food Bank, because no one should go hungry. Thursday through Sunday, July 4th through 7th, KBOO will broadcast live from Tom McCall Waterfront Park to the Portland metro area. Throughout Oregon, via radio partners in Ashland, Bend, Newport, Warm Springs, Salem, and more, as well as web streaming at kboo.fm. More information about admission, performers, and benefits for KBOO members can be found at kboo.fm.